Hey everybody, it's Max. We've got a very special episode this week with our friends Paul and Storm. Before we get to that, I've got a couple of things to tell you about. The first thing, most important thing, is we're doing a very fun concert with Paul and Storm. I know Pat will be there as well. It's called Concert Against Humanity. It is during Gen Con this year. It's the evening of August 5th. If you're if you live in Indianapolis, or frankly, if you're anywhere in the Midwest or even the continental United States, or if you even have access to an airport, please come to this show. We're I don't want to say we're desperate to sell tickets, but it will be very bad for our company if we do not sell more tickets. So please go to concertagainsthumanity.com and get some tickets to this hilarious show. I feel like I didn't lead with
you. Don't even need to go to the show just buy tickets.
We don't care.
It would be better if you did not come.
Here's the thing, is I feel like I didn't lead with the F's and B's here. You got to lead with the features and benefits, which is good people, good talented people, not us, but Eugene Merman and Jonathan Colton.
Hey, I'm a talent. I'm a super talent.
And Pat.
I'm Mad Fly.
And also Pat will be there.
He's not actually booked. He's just going to show up because that's what
he does. He'll sit in your seat if you don't come.
If he finds his way backstage, there's a chance that he'll have a segment on the show.
Pat Rothfuss will be giving every single attendee of this show a hearty, lengthy hug. A lingering embrace.
Maybe not if they heard last week's episode about the boy penis.
This is true.
Second item that I've got to promote is the Joco Cruise. It is this year. It's from March 4th to 11th. I've been on the Joco Cruise. I enjoy myself as much as I'm really capable of enjoying myself in any situation. But the cruise.
Another ringing endorsement from Max Temkin.
The cruise is really crazy fun. They're going to be announcing some of the lineup, and it's just insane this year. It's the first year that they have the whole ship. It's sailing out of San Diego and going down the Gulf of California, which Storms told me to refer to as the Sea of Cortez.
The Sea of Cortez, much like a rich Corinthian leather.
if you like this podcast and you're a nerd, let's be honest, if you're listening to Pat and I talk about Marvel Comics every week, you're a nerd. Please go on this cruise. You'll find like-minded people and just a wonderful, fun, very welcoming and inviting group and very fun activities, and it's a ton of fun.
It is the emotional equivalent of this podcast for a week on a cruise ship.
But mine is the uncomfortable parts,
think. Okay. Maybe not quite as many baby penis stories.
Yeah.
Unless that's what you enjoy.
This is false advertising. I'm going to be on the cruise. I'm helping John Scalzi moderate plan the writer's track. I'm going to be up on the stage too, so you will hear about my children. And they're nudists, right? It's like everybody in the Rothfuss house is a not secret nudist. And there's a definite chance that you'll see my child's naked ass on this cruise.
Wow, we haven't even started yet. All right. But anyway, go to jococruise.com for all of that and more.
You just jacked our insurance rates up.
Yeah.
500%.
All right, here we go. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Max.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Listeners of the show may notice that this is probably the best-sounding episode we've ever recorded. That is, of course, because we are sitting in the same room together. I'm making eye contact with you right now.
It's kind of weird, Max, you looking directly at me and talking to I can't look away, but I'm still not entirely comfortable.
This week, Pat and I are hanging out in Chicago. Pat has come by the Cards Against Humanity podcast studio here. And not only do you guys get to enjoy that, but we are also joined by friends of the show and, famous internet musicians.
Yeah, we'll go
performers.
With that. Sure.
Defenders of the faith?
No, I was gonna say defenders of the realm. I think that is what I will officially dub.
Yeah,
I'll take that.
Show us a realm. We will defend it.
Paul and Storm.
Hello.
Hi there.
We went to see, Don't Tell Me last night.
We did.
The NPR News quiz hosted by our friend Peter Sagal, very generously got us tickets. And Paul, I believe when you came up to say hi to Pat and I, you mentioned you've been listening to the show and you felt like the show needed a grown-up.
Yeah. Well, when we were discussing it last night, you guys described yourselves as we're like Bert and Ernie, and I tend to think of you more as Ernie and anal retentive Ernie. And then last night this morning I was discussing it with my wife, and I realized that a more apt description of you is you're both Ernie, just one of you is country mouse and one of you is city mouse.
I think the term that Max and I have thrown back and forth is helpless man babies.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Helpless man babies with too much money.
which is my Justin Bieber cover band.
There it is. There it is.
Have we ever, did we ever tell on the podcast the story of how, like, the two of us, it took 3 hours to rent a car?
Oh, boy.
Let's get into this. All right. It's time to rip the cover off of the...
So I think this came about on a previous visit to Chicago. We did a show with the Double Clicks. Was that, I think that was it, right?
I think that was it.
And you were in Chicago, and that night you were trying to drive back to Stevens Point, which is quite a drive. And you were renting a car at a car rental place.
Well, I was hoping to rent a car because I'd flown into Chicago and I was just going to drive home.
Right. So Pat and this is an anecdote. There's no way I'm getting out of this without sounding a little bit like an asshole, but Pat and I are both we've done financially successful things. Like, we both
You've done very well for yourself.
Yeah, we're both like, we have all of we have access to all of the things that, you know, a typical grown-up should have access to. And we go to like an enterprise rent-a-car to get Pat a car, and we realize that between the two of us, we did not have like two responsibilities to rub together. Like,
yeah.
All of the things they need for a driver to get the car, we did not have between us. So like, neither of us hold a major credit card.
Uh-huh.
Neither.
Well, I did have a credit card, but I didn't have a valid license
because
it had expired. And I'm like, here's a passport. I am an adult. Look at me. I've rented cars from you before. I'm in your system. And they're like, no, we need a valid license.
And the deal was I had the license, but I've never had a credit card.
So it was this huge endeavor to like jump through these hoops. And it was almost to the point where I just was going to look at the guy and I'm like, listen, here's my book. Just look at this. Like, number one New York Times.
Oh, yeah, no, that, yeah, that.
No, and say, just like, I have better shit to do with my time than steal your goddamn car. This is Max Temkin, right? He runs Cards Against Humanity. Just let me have a fucking car so I can go
home.
Then
they were like, they have backup procedures for like what happens when you walk in.
A couple of man overly moneyed man babies wander in.
If you were actual cartoon characters, and this is what Paul and I do when we run into this situation, we go out, we find an outrageously large trench coat, and one of us will be the bottom of the top. And
yeah, I was seriously going to ask if you end, like, I really want this story to end with like Max getting on Pat's shoulders and you guys driving Master Blaster style out of the rental place.
Yeah, Pat works the pedals and I do the wheel. Yeah, their backup procedures were involved. Like, they were like, well, can you produce like a utility bill for the place that you live? or like, I don't know, like a pay stub. And I was like, I don't have any of that stuff.
I would love if you were carrying those things around with you, but not
a
credit card.
But I was like, I can't have a pay stub. Like, I don't get paid.
I'm
like,
the boss.
Yeah, like, I got nothing.
Then it went into the civics lesson.
And who gets a utility bill, like, printed and delivered these days?
Right. I think I've dug something up in my email. I mean, they did let us get the car.
They did, eventually, but it was... And luckily, it's like the time issue wasn't pressing. You were very kind to help me out because I honestly did expect to be able to like get off the plane and kind of sweet talk my way through that situation.
Oh,
you know,
Pat.
And like, I'm like, look, here's a license. I can drive. It just expired. I was off in Europe while it expired. Here's my passport. I've rented a car from you before. And you know, like, the truth is, I'm pretty. And people like doing things for pretty people. I figured I'd flash a little leg.
It's not even so much about the pretty. It's that you're cuddly.
Yeah.
That's a type of pretty.
And you are 98% of the time non-threatening.
Since the time we went to this enterprise rent a car, you've really pulled things together. But I do remember on that particular trip, your shoes were literally falling to tatters.
Yeah.
And you had like holes in your clothes. And the line between genius author and itinerant hobo.
Like Sid Barrett wandered into the rental company.
Right. You have to ask yourself, would you have rented a car to you?
Yeah, looking like you write fantasy novels and you came out of a fantasy novel is it's a fine line.
Yes, did you wave your staff at them and threaten them with curses? And...
Do not meddle with the affairs of authors.
I have a discussion topic that came out of our last week's episode, Pat, which is last week you and I were sort of talking about neo-hedonism. So like this idea of trying to figure out a life for yourself where all of the things you do aren't just like getting the most money, getting the most pleasure, as you put it, like getting 100 cakes, right? And it strikes me like something I really like about all of you guys and about working with all of you guys and like doing concerts and stuff is I think that's a little bit of an ethic that runs through all of our work is, you know, you guys are, you know, so I'm looking at Paul and Storm right now. You guys are incredibly focused on making these wonderful experiences for other people and about doing, you know, cause-based stuff and working with Pat on World Builder stuff and also doing incredibly kind things to help other musicians who are sort of coming up. And Pat, obviously, you know, I think a lot of your waking hours go to World Builders. And I'm probably more of a piece of shit, but...
you do nothing, Max Temkin.
I write fart jokes and make the people laugh. So that's...
our resume.
Justified yeah. our positions in the world.
Yeah, there you go. But anyway, but I was sort of curious, like, I think that's always an interesting... it's an interesting thing to ask people about, because a lot of times, like, when I go to a conference and I hear people talk, they the lesson of their life that they want to portray to people is they're like, follow your dreams, like do whatever makes you happy. Or, you know, I think, in fact, I even heard our friend Jonathan Colton give a talk. And one of the things that he talked about was this idea of like, follow your bliss, like he put like a happy face icon mm-hmm. up on the screen. He was like, follow that. That's your signpost. And I'm curious, like, because I think all of us have done at times things other than that, like. Is that the main motivating factor for you guys when you're like tired and you're on the road and you're hustling?
Yeah, I'd say that it's definitely that we'd rather be doing this stuff than anything else. I'd put an asterisk on the follow your dreams, follow your bliss, which is you learn sort of what the world will accept from you and you can try to adapt to get the world to accept whatever it is you want to do. But you'll find for most people that if you adapt yourself some, doesn't mean give up on your dreams, but to sort of recognize when you should keep pushing through and when maybe, you know, if you want to be an opera singer and you don't have an opera voice, well, you know, maybe not. But there might be something that's adjacent to that. So what I'm saying is I'm here to crush dreams. That's it's what I'm doing. I'm a steamroller. No, I think it is.
But it's like I think it's a bit like no one gets into being an independent musician because of how easy of a career it is and because of the money and the acclaim you get for it.
Nobody who lasts, I think, mm-hmm. Uses that as their motivation. I mean, I generally give the same advice. My asterisk to the whole follow your bliss thing is don't be a friggin' idiot about it. you know, do it. I don't want to come across like a super old dad type dude when I say do it responsibly, because that's not necessarily what I would do. Have some sense of responsibility and realism when you attack it. And when I say that, I mean things like, are you responsible for keeping a child alive in the world when you're doing this yeah. and maybe quitting your high-powered job to go pursue decoupage as a career isn't necessarily, maybe you don't want to go all in on that at once if you've got a two-year-old at home that you're responsible for feeding and not having die, that sort of thing. Like, find ways, there's ways to pursue your dream that don't necessarily involve dropping everything else on the planet and only doing that dream. Maybe I'm telling you to compromise. I don't know, but I feel like there are degrees to which you can do it. Do it to the point where you're not harming others, basically, is what I'm saying. When people ask us about this, when they're in like their 20s, you're like a high school kid or something, you're saying, I'm really interested in doing music or whatever. I'm like, this is the time to do it when you're not responsible for other people. You're young. That's the whole point of your 20s, is to make mistakes and fuck up, learn what you're good at, learn what you're not good at, and you don't have a super huge impact on the rest of the world by doing all of that fucking up and learning.
Miss that, mama.
I would say there's still a way to do it at any time in your life, and I believe this, but that it doesn't mean you should just drop everything right away and pursue it. Maybe, but that there are, like, Jonathan Colton is, I think, one of the best cases. He didn't just one day decide, all right, now I'm going to try to be a rock star for real after having given up the dream. He never gave up the dream, and he always pursued it to some degree, both in his mind. He was always doing music. But then there came that point where, you know, he and his wife decided, okay, let's, you know, take a year and just go for it. So there was kind of a good spot to try it.
But, and you guys are super pussyfooting around this thing where, like, it's like, don't necessarily pursue your dream, everyone, because honestly, a lot of your dreams are really not very smart. I mean, and I'm not saying that you guys aren't smart. I'm saying that a lot of times the things that we fix in our minds as these ideals or these fantasies, you know, I went out with a woman at one point, and she knew that, like, what she wanted in life, you know, was this. She goes, I want to get married, and I want to have kids, and I want to have this house in the country with a white picket fence. And actually said that. I'm not kind of hyperbolizing or summarizing or belittling with a stereotype. That's really what she said. And I'm like, oh, really? I'm like, so that's what you're aiming for? And she's like, yeah. She goes, I've wanted that since I was 13. Now, there's two versions of this. There's one, because sometimes people do actually, honest to God, know what they want to do, and then they can pursue it, and then they get it, and then they're happy. However, that is super rare, right?
Yeah.
Because either you change your mind, or you get it, and it doesn't make you happy, or you try to get it, and you can't. You know, there's a bunch of things that go wrong on that road. But, you know, and then on the other, in the other hand, one of my friends in high school always wanted to be a rocket scientist, like aerospace engineer, and he was super smart. And then he went to college and he became an aerospace engineer, and now he works for Boeing. And so, yeah, I mean, you can do that. But I think my thing will be to say, like, your dream doesn't have to be your career. As a matter of fact, I would really highly recommend not ever thinking in those terms if you really want to pursue something and genuinely be happy. Because, I mean, I never did.
Yeah.
You know, I really never did. I always knew that I liked writing. I thought it would be cool to write. And so it's like, well, I've got to go to college now. What am I going to do? How about chemical engineering? You know, because eventually I will want to buy food.
Yeah.
And I knew that the raw data was against me that, and I think I've quoted it here before. My rule of thumb was of every 250 people that start a book, one finishes it. Of every 250 people that finish a book, one of them gets published. Out of every 250 people that, that publish a book, one of them gets to make a gets to do it as their day job.
So it's authors all the way down is what you're saying.
Really, really. And honestly, there's one more in front of that that I forgot to mention. Of every 250 people that want to start writing a book, you know, that think about it, only one actually starts.
Yeah.
I think my friend Zach Gage is a friend of the show. Zach Gage is a fine artist in New York. And I think he mentioned to me, I hope I'm not misquoting this, but I think he mentioned to me that he thinks there's about 300 people who make a living making fine art.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Right.
Which is crazy. If you think of all the museums in all of the worlds that are showing new art that's being made, there's about a circle of 300 people that can sell their art enough to support themselves doing it.
Well, and I say this again and again in terms of, you know, and I really buck, you know, I end up on these panels at conventions and I constantly preach. It's weird because writing is the only hobby that exists where you're considered a failure if you don't become a professional.
Hmm.
Because think about it. You know, there's all these people out there and they're all writing and they're all, and once you've written a story, right, you want to submit it. And if once you submit, you want to get published and you want to get paid and you want to climb this ladder. But like, let's say you're a gardener. You know, if you're a gardener, you know, nobody comes up to you and says, hey, you know, wow, this is a really beautiful garden. When are you going to be in Better Homes and Gardens?
Yeah.
You know, nobody, and you know, you garden because you love being outside and you love digging in the dirt and you love fruit or flowers, you know, depending on your style. And you get paid through the joy of your pursuit of your hobby.
Is your dream the ends or is your dream the means?
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing if you say your dream is I want to be a famous musician. It's even another thing to say, I want to make a living being a musician, but the more realistic dream, at least, and maybe the one you should approach with, is I would like to make music.
Yes, and that those are three entirely separate things.
And I think a lot of people, when they say my dream is to be a professional writer, musician, artist, whatever, I think what a lot of people are saying is I really don't want to work for someone else.
Yeah.
Really. And that if you want to make a living off of the fruits of your mind or whatever it is, know that it's hard work, you know, and that you have to be adaptable to do it, which isn't to say you shouldn't pursue it. Be honest with yourself, because really, if it's the joy of doing it, yeah, absolutely. You can do gardening and get joy. You can do writing and get joy and not have to sweat whether or not the whole world thinks it's awesome or you can make a living from it.
This is another thing where I feel like baked into this whole, the whole, the whole sort of like motivational talk philosophy of like, here's, you know, the most important thing is to do what makes you happy and to follow your happiness.
Right,
and
you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. That doesn't actually, when I think about it, it doesn't really hold up to a lot of scrutiny.
Nope.
Because what it really, what people seem to be saying is, Do it, you know, just from like a more like utilitarian point of view, people are saying do whatever increases your utility.
Yeah.
And you would never give that advice to like to anyone else in any other social circumstance. Like it's terrible advice.
We need the Star Trek economy that's basically based on, you know, society agreeing that, hey, that's cool, you know, or that it's utterly necessary.
You know, our friend Merlin Mann has this great thing he said.
Friend
before.
Of the show, Merlin Mann.
Friend of the show, Merlin Mann. I'm never going to stop saying that now that you brought that up.
I started a meme.
Yeah, friend of the show, our dear friend Merlin Mann. He has this great thing about like, there's no such thing as like being a writer the noun. There, no one ever hands you a certificate and says you're a writer the noun. What there is writing the verb, which is that you sit down and you operate the keyboard and you write things.
Yeah.
And writing, I think, is something that, I don't, just to take the happiness out of the equation, I think writing is something that's fulfilling. It's something that can lead to a good life. It's productive. It can be lucrative. It can reach other people and be a conduit to talk to people with your art. But being a writer is kind of, and especially having that as a benchmark for success in your life, it seems like a recipe for misery.
Yeah.
It's also not a monolithic thing. You know, like you can be a writer and be writing stuff that you just don't enjoy. And then if is that important to you to make your living through words if it's not something that's bringing you joy?
Well, and, you know, we touched on it, or at least I went off on it, which is kind of the same as touching on it. It's the whole concept of the American dream. It's like, you know, you can, you know, grow up to be a best-selling author or a rock star or a, you know, you know, game designer or all these, you know, whatever, but, you know,
you probably won't.
But the truth is, like, you know, if somebody at Taco Bell makes my burrito well, that has a absolute fucking effect on my day.
Sure.
You know, and part of, and it's not part of, it's a foundational problem in our country, in our culture, and in our economy.
Here comes the manifesto.
That people do not value labor.
Yeah.
Labor is fucking essential. And part of the problem is if right now people work like dogs and they don't get paid because, again, we don't value this economically or culturally. We don't respect people that go out and work like dogs, and therefore it's reflected they do not typically get paid well,
mm-hmm.
and therefore they do not have good lives, and it's not respected in the culture, people viewing this. And
to me,
so,
that's the key word is respect.
Respect. And like the truth is, you know, I had a bus driver growing up. You know, he drove the school bus, and that guy had a huge impact on my life. And I know that he probably, and I was almost going to say he wasn't paid what he was worth. But that's the wrong way of thinking about it. It's like, think about this. A person driving a bus full of school children, This is a huge, huge responsibility. You want somebody doing that job who that is a valuable job. And therefore, you should pay this person money, like serious money.
Yeah,
I would never take that job just because that's too much responsibility. Similarly, when we were talking about, you know, we were looking to bring in a babysitter. And, you know, Sarah's response to me talking about like how we should hire a babysitter was similar to the way I think about couches. When we went couch shopping, I'm like, you can spend $1,000 on a couch? Because I'd never spent more than 40 in my life. And normally I would just harvest a couch. A couch is something.
Gone to the woods.
You want
time for the couch culling.
Pat strolls by the dumpster. Ah, it's been a bountiful harvest this season.
Yeah. I used to have this beautiful blue couch. We called it Entropy Couch. If you laid on it, you'd had to fight to not sleep. It generated its own heat. That was
from all the mites running around inside.
Whatever works.
It was this beautiful couch. And so then we went couch shopping, and I'm like, $1,200, and I'd sit on it, and it was just uncomfortable, and it was ugly, and you couldn't even pull the fucking
the cushions off to make a fort.
That's what you pay for a couch that's not soaked in urine.
Well, yes. Then piss on something and make it comfortable. Is that the secret?
There are stores that will do that for you.
Yeah. You but have to pay top dollar.
But I'm going to reel this back away from couches. Mm-hmm. The fuck was I talking about?
You're talking about paying people what they were worth.
Yeah, right.
Bus
so
drivers.
Babysitters.
Why don't we just respect the simple labor of the couch pisser? It's a hard job.
Because we're not willing to pay the couch pisser.
Well, in Europe, though, the pissoir is very, very respected.
The highest
more so
level
than
of
even
society.
The prime minister, I believe.
Well, I think there's such a focus in this country in the last 20, 30 years on those people who produce wealth or are able to get it from others versus those who make people's lives better or take on responsibility, this weird D-link.
Yeah. And so I was actually talking to Sarah about like bringing in a babysitter. And I'm like, we're going to have to pay this person. And she's like, you know, babysitters make like $5, you know, and they're happy at, you know, making $5. And I'm like, I want a responsible, and now Max is shuddering. Keep in mind, I live in small town Wisconsin, but also like Sarah, you know, she's dealing with kind of a family economy. She's thinking, let's bring in a 13-year-old girl, be totally happy making $20 for an evening. And I'm like, no. I want somebody who is smart, who will interact well with my children.
Never cross.
Speaks with a British accent. Sings lessons.
Also, who's going to like maintain my standards of discipline? Who, if something goes wrong, this person will not like run around like a chicken with their head cut off.
Plus, I think I live close enough to you that I'd get the Amber Alert when they abscond with your children. So you never want that.
And I said, you know, if we aren't paying this person a living wage, who in our lives will be doing a more important service to us?
Who watches the Watchmen, Pat?
This babysitter.
Who watches the Watchmen's children?
Exactly.
And finally she was like, oh God, you're right. This is super important. Why would you try, why would you bring in why would you pay, go to the cheapest
bidder? The lowest
bidder,
sure.
And the truth is like I like to pay this person a living wage and then they want to stay and do good work and then they have a good life. And then they get to like buy healthy food and have a car that isn't going to blow up and maybe even buy a house someday. And like that's how shit should work.
Well, I think it used to be the whole babysitter was when, you know, there were neighborhoods and extended families and the babysitter was just sort of a little patch that fit into a larger framework. And now the whole building is resting on that column when they're sitting.
Yeah.
Can I throw a crazy sci-fi twist into the conversation?
Yeah,
let's enter the sci-fi twist zone. It's our official sci-fi twist sound effect.
Don't make me grab the slide whistle. Don't make me do it. My hand's on the slide whistle.
It's the Asimov horn.
Yeah. But no, Storm, you brought this up with the Star Trek reference. And I think this is very interesting. It's actually not all that much sci-fi. But I think possibly within our lifetime, we're going to enter the era where labor is not as necessary as it is today.
So we're halfway there.
It slowly seems to be happening, right? But like to use the example you mentioned of the bus driver, right? If a person drives a bus, that's a very important job. But there's no reason for a person to drive a bus because the best person at driving a bus is a little bit worse than a mediocre machine driving a bus.
Yeah.
So if you think about how many jobs in America are, you know, truck drivers is the most common job in most states in America. That's already in the very close to going away forever. You know, you have any sort of like hospitality, any, you know, construction, like just tons and tons and tons of jobs. And I can sort of see that. I mean, I feel like that's kind of an economic fact over a long enough period of time that it's going to happen. And I can sort of see two paths that we can take as like the human species. Path one is the like hyper capitalist path, and this is the Marxist idea of the value, the supply value of labor, where it's like as there's more and more labor in the labor pool, there's more supply of labor and less demand for labor, meaning the value of labor plummets, labor is worth very little, and there's lots of people who want very few jobs, and the working people become this like ultra cheap commodity that can be bought and sold with very little consideration. And conditions are terrible for everybody.
So they're all like in the back of the Snowpiercer train.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
That's the metaphor, right? And then you have the very few people who control the means of production at the top who get to pick from this huge pool of labor. That's a nightmare scenario that we could have. Option number two is we stop we have to reconsider like what money is and what a living is, right? And we realize, well, if we don't need all this labor, that should actually free everyone from the constraints of having or not having things. Because what does it mean to own property if the labor is removed from it, right? So like there has to be some more equitable way where we can decide who gets what, who gets land, who gets resources.
The tricky thing is for everyone in the equation involved to agree on what the point is.
Right.
So who should get what and when.
Well, that's not even the tricky thing. It's that the people that are, control production now also have their thumb on, or yeah, I was going to say their thumb on the scales, but no, it's more accurate to say they have their both hands in every pie possible,
but
that are going to control, because ultimately this has to be a governing body. A government would have to step in and say, oh, okay, everyone, you know, how about everybody gets a warm place to sleep where they're safe, nutritious food, education, and medical care.
But to get everybody to agree, especially the people who do have those means, I think you need to say why. And I think there's a good answer for it, is that you think about the Renaissance and other times when there have been great ideas, it's because people are no longer have to worry about basic survival. They can turn their minds towards other things, whether it's art or science. And that if you think of it that way, as, hey, if suddenly we can harvest all of humanity's brain power, and granted, some people are going to create great things, some people are just going to, you know, be along and be decent people.
There's going to be so many one-man shows.
you're going to have a few rocket scientists. You're going to have a few Kardashians.
But the more people you have in this pool, the greater your results are going to be. Personally, I believe that, you know, being able to dodge asteroids is a pretty good goal for humanity. You know, it's not an end of it in and of itself.
So my question is, so I think there's the debate of like, well, which path do we choose? Do we choose the like dystopian, basically like prison population view, or is there some sort of like Star Trek post-economy, coming together, like cosmopolitan joining of humanity where we figure out something else? But I think really another interesting question to think about in this like sci-fi world is like, let's say that you were freed from the necessities of labor, right? You have robots doing most of the labor better than people could do it. What would people do with their lives?
I think it just depends on the individual. Like some people are just driven to feel like they need to be productive or use their minds, whatever it is. And that's what I meant by people agreeing on what the point is. Because if suddenly, you know, I can just get food, I have a place to stay, then what's the point?
Right.
Sudoku, I believe.
Well, if your whole life philosophy is do whatever makes you happy, and you can have whatever you want, that you're going to reach the ceiling of that very quickly.
So here's the, Max, if you wanted to, you could probably, you would never have to work in order to make money to live at this point in your life, right?
That is probably true.
You couldn't live lavishly. You couldn't buy yachts. You couldn't go to the moon.
You could exist comfortably.
You could exist comfortably.
That's probably true.
And I know I am in the same boat. Mostly in my case, because I live in small town Wisconsin and you can buy a house for less than $100,000 there. but so I know I could actually, you know, just kind of never work again. And so like, why do I not?
I will find you and hunt you down if you don't finish the third fucking
book. There's so many angry nerds' fingers hovering over keyboards.
Yeah. Pitchforks.
Please email your comments to Pat. If you have any thoughts on this episode, Pat is at Patrick Rothfuss on Twitter.
They're mentally willing us, like, steer him away from this. Steer him away. But back towards the goal.
Well, and think about this. You know, imagine, you know, any of you out there, imagine you win the lottery. You know, and not $100 million. But maybe you make $1 million. And let's say that's after taxes, nice round $1 million. That means you, depending on where you live in the country and what sort of student debt you have, right? That means you can probably erase your debt, buy a house, put some money in the bank, and probably live pretty comfortably for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, depending on how frugal you are, how you feel about fancy cars. So what would you do? I mean, what would you really do? Would you quit your job and just, you know, like eat Cheetos and sit in front of the TV all day? Because, I mean, and the thing is, I think a lot of people might, and I don't think that's wrong.
No, I don't think it is either. So long as especially if it were something where energy is abundant, there are resources, you know, why do I care if this person just lives that existence? It's if that person believes, well, I should have the same thing that the person that is working so much, et cetera, that you have conflict, or right, because I inherently this or that, that I should have more than those people.
It's and that's where I think our monkey biology fucks us, because, you know, it's what I've heard people refer to as junk code. You know, there are these mechanisms we have in place that turned us into very successful monkeys that make us really shitty humans. Because, like, if I have a TV and a smartphone and I can play Fallout on my computer, and, you know, I have happy, fat, healthy children, and then I look across the street and I see somebody with a bigger house and they have twice as many Cheetos, maybe, and maybe they don't work as hard as I feel like I work. Like, am I suddenly sad? Do I suddenly feel like the universe is shit on me? Now, the monkey part of me goes, it's like, and then, like, why does this person have these resources that should be mine? That's just like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Man, you got everything you need. You can just live your own life. And the fact that somebody else might have more than you and not be working as hard.
That's what country music is trying to tell us all.
that's the thing, though, is that I could have all the luxuries of, like, the post-labor world. I could have all of my needs met completely externally, but you'll still have the higher-grade heroin and the newer model of the blowjob robot. And I'm going to look at Pat, and I'm going to say, how is that fair?
When the blowjob robot gets perfected,
The Blowtron 3000?
We did write a Cards Against Humanity card that just fucking killed us, that was a cheerful blowjob robot.
A cheerful?
Yeah. I would play that every game.
Oh, hey, guys. how's it going?
What are we
going
to do today? Oh, that again? Okay.
Who's up for a little? Anybody want a blowjob? That's why I'm here. That's why I was created. I'm just happy to hang out, you guys.
Oh, come on, guys. Let's turn those frowns upside down. I got just the ticket.
You know, I'm always here for you.
Why are all these robots Mickey Mouse?
Because isn't that what everybody wants, giving them a blowjob, Mickey Mouse?
It'll be heavily branded.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking Mickey. That sounded a little bit like... I was picturing kind of more of a Howdy Doody.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Oh, please.
It's the, like, uncanny Mickey valley Mouse's of blowjob robots.
And, you know, I'm never going to see that Card Max and not imagine this little 3-foot-high puppetish thing traipsing
just
through
a
the
nightmare
cards
marionette
office. Yeah, like going, hey, everybody. Hey, how's it? You know, it's like it's still a prototype, but it's really improved morale.
Well, it looks like you guys are really having a party here.
Well, see, that's just one of the things that humanity can turn its minds to if we free ourselves up.
We need...
I mean, the Japanese are practically there.
Yeah, they're so far ahead of us.
Well, the problem
is they keep catching up.
They keep getting hung up trying to perfect the used panty distribution machine.
So that's a sidetrack. It's a mirage.
They can't move past that to the blowjob machines. It's just it's the linear thinking of the Japanese.
Wasting all their development points on that fruitless development right,
exactly.
dream.
Side quest.
They put all their points into, like, charisma. Like,
why did you do that?
Yeah. Mecha suits and anti-distribute this. Were we just racist, everyone?
Probably.
Were we just racist? Okay.
Well, to be fair, I don't see a whole lot of other countries with used panty vending machines.
All right. I know Paul and Storm have to go in a minute. I'm very eager to hear the story about your kid's trip to the zoo. Did they encounter the alive gorilla?
the mythical alive gorilla. We went to the zoo. There was jaguars. You know, we saw.
So
the
I know, Pat. I know your children. I mean, they're basically raised like veal. I mean, they're poor kids. They don't have internet. They don't have Minecraft. They don't have TV. They have nothing. So they come out into the zoo, and it's just the amount of stimulation, it blows them back on their feet. I mean, they can't handle it.
It's like coming out of the house into Oz, into Munchkin Land.
Right.
Oh my God, everything's in color. Yeah. There's this weird lady in a bubble floating at me.
Yeah.
You know, it's great because my kids went to the zoo. And they're like, jaguar, lions, tiger. And it was cool. And they wanted to look at that. And, you know, otters, you know, or not the otters, the seals, also a big hit. And then my boy saw a sparrow land on the sidewalk. And he's like, dad, bird. And I'm like, that bird is pretty awesome. You know what it's called? He's like, I don't know. He goes, it's a sparrow. He goes, oh. He goes, I didn't know that they could be that small. And see, this is, you know, this is the benefit to you raising children, you know, with
raising hermetically sealed children.
You know, well, I would say...
And their resale value, you keep them in the original mint and packaging. Yeah.
You know, all of you with your kids who are plugged into these devices and you can't get their attention and you wonder why they're so, lacking in
affect. To be fair, Pat, I raised two daughters. They probably watched a good 12 to 18 hours of television a day.
28 hours of television a day.
My point being, they knew what a goddamn sparrow was.
Yeah, how great is that? It's like, I'm on the internet every minute of my life. I see a sparrow, it does nothing for me, but it's a shitty little sparrow.
My child is full of joy.
Yeah, that's true. My kids just Snapchatted the sparrow and went back on to Facebook, so... Touché.
You know, what it really is, think of, I'm going to go all the way back to Iron Chef, right? Because I'm assuming every person in their right mind has watched those old Iron Chef.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kaga approves.
And there was the one with the American went over and was just a eight kinds of asshole on the show. But he was the one that used all like the intense spice. And so his strategy was to make this incredibly spicy meal because the judges eat the challenger's meal first.
And
it fucks up your whole flavor thing. Like if you eat a bunch of spice and a bunch of intense flavor and whatever, then the subtle things,
right, your palate becomes muted.
Yep. And the subtle things, it's like you can't appreciate them. And that was his whole strategy. And so my strategy is, it's like, why am I going to lead out with a bunch of super intense experiences? Right now my children enjoy cardboard boxes, cardboard tubes, sparrows.
Basically, your children are cats.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, I'm going to keep them as long as they're happy, that's fine. And then when they start to get dissatisfied, then it's like, hey guys, paint and tape.
here's a milk crate.
Yeah.
It's like a cardboard box you can't rip.
So basically, by the time they reach their 50th birthday is when you wheel out the Atari 2600.
Yes. Yeah,
this is called adventure.
So final question for Paul and Storm. I'm not trying to keep you from the SpongeBob musical. I know you guys
we have an important date.
You guys are on your way.
Date with SpongeBob.
Occasionally on this podcast, Pat and I set some sort of ill-fated personal goal for like self-improvement for ourselves. So some examples of that would be like not trying to like use our phone as an alarm clock. So
real
it's
goals,
like,
not like have a robotic arm by next week.
Yeah, like achievable things in our lives that would,
realistic things we won't do as opposed to stupid things we won't do.
That's not stupid at
Paul,
all.
This is like,
tell
you know,
you, want
you
a
were
robotic
complaining
arm.
We don't have the grown up on this show. Yeah. So here we go. We've got boat dads. Right here in the studio with
Uncle
us.
Uncle Boat and Uncle Boat.
Yeah, give us some challenges. I mean,
give you a challenge. Okay, I got
like
a challenge.
You've listened to the
show.
I have
a specific challenge for you, Max Temkin.
Well, wait a minute. What's Pat getting off free here?
No, I'll get to him in a second.
Right.
Pat, introduce your children to a screen. It doesn't have to be turned on. Just put a screen in your house. No, Max Temkin, mm-hmm. I challenge you in the next week to go buy some goddamn flatware. And here is specifically your task. For several episodes ago, there was a lengthy discussion about how you were on this Quixotian, Don Quixotian quest for perfect
one
flatware.
One does not simply buy flatware, Paul.
No, as a matter of fact, one absolutely does that. You are going to go into a Macy's.
Uh-huh.
Or the equivalent big store. Uh-huh. Not a Target, not a Walmart. Go into like a Macy's or a what have you. Uh-huh. Going to go to the wedding registry area where they have the china and the glasses, and you're going to look at the different flatware that they have there, and you're going to pick one of them, and you're going to buy 12 of each.
They're all unacceptable.
12?
They're all unacceptable.
Because that way, that you never need more than 12. Well, you can buy an extra bunch of your little demi-glace spoons or whatever
it is. How many friends do you people have? You need 12 sets of...
I'm going like 20. You have people over for dinner. You get a big dinner party.
Yeah, you need lots of room to entertain. Have you never watched House Hunters?
Yeah.
My house is too full of crap to have people over.
That's what catering halls are for.
No, you're gonna. I don't care. They're all always going to be unacceptable. That's the point. You are never going to find the perfect flatware. So you're going to have to set yourself the goal of find the least unacceptable flatware that is there in that particular Macy's, and you're going to order 12 knives, 12 forks, and 12 spoons.
Now, actually, how about this? Can I spin this?
Okay, spin it.
Because, you know, what I've realized in my own thing is I have a very geeky but very paralyzing desire for perfection, and we've bumped into this before, right? And you can get option paralysis because you want to make the best decision. And you know that there are 1,000 bad decisions you could make, so you never make any decision. Mm-hmm. And so how about this? Instead of forcing him to commit to a full set, mm-hmm. right, he gets to go in and find a set.
Buy one set and test it?
One, or maybe like one or two sets, so uh-huh. he can have and like have them running and wash a set. And the thing is, he will buy it. And it might not even have to be physical. I would say it'd be okay because he cruises the interwebs. Mm-hmm. But he would get a couple, and here's how I can pitch it to Max so I know he'll do it. You'll get it, and you'll hate it, but the way in which you hate it will help you define what it is you really want for your final purchase.
Well, I know what I hate about all of these.
What's that?
Oh, various. I can't even begin to enumerate all of the okay. different factors. No, I mean, there's the hand feel, there's the weight, there's the balance, there's the material it's made out of, there's whether it'll hold its finish. There's the geometry of it. There's the relationship of all of the forks to the other things.
Yeah, you know what I'm hearing? I'm hearing nerd.
The thing is, fork. What do you eat with right now?
Well, it's like an amalgamation of like weird IKEA.
Does the food end up in your mouth?
Well, does it? That's a separate problem that I have.
Does the food usually end up in your mouth?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so basically, this is not necessarily a lifetime commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can be there and have a thing that is more or less cohesive
mm-hmm.
without it being don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good flatware.
No, no, no. Wait, I've got an even better idea. Everyone.
Okay.
Everyone, I'm guessing on the website Max has constructed, there is a reference to his P.O. box somewhere. That strikes me as the sort of thing that Max would have thought ahead and instituted somewhere. Everyone out there probably has a favorite sort of fork.
Ooh.
You know, you have your own team.
I do want to say, speaking of the I don't want to derail you here, but the internet has, by the way, our fans have spoken, Pat, and they're very pro Tiny Spoon. Literally not one comment in favor of your stupid
okay,
big spoon.
Consider this, sitting here on a microphone mm-hmm. carries the weight of 1,000 comments typed out.
Mm-hmm.
Tiny spoon has its place, but you need some big spoons.
No, you gotta have both.
You don't need now. I'm not necessarily the full pat giant huge spoon,
mm-hmm.
but like if you're gonna eat some ice cream, I feel like a teaspoon is your really go to.
This is actually a topic we've had in our house because I'm normal spoon guy, and
yeah.
Specifically on ice cream, I love big spoon in general. Like if I'm eating chili, I'm eating it with a big moon sized spoon.
Right.
But Mrs. Storm is in the big spoon camp. Like she just delights. In that feeling of having this mound of ice cream, there it is. Here comes the ice cream truck.
Can I put forward a theory of spoon size utility decision making? It's sort
sure.
of a, this would be a sort of a heuristic for spoon selection.
Yeah, bring order to chaos on spoons.
it's a working theory. I haven't really thought through it yet, but I think you got two kinds of foods. As everyone knows, there's two main categories of food. You got food with stuff in it and food without stuff in it.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Now chili, a good chili, lots of stuff. You've got your chili, you got your beans, your meat, your cheese, your crunchy things, your little green onions.
This mm-hmm. this is known.
You have all sorts of stuff, right? You want a big spoon because what do you want in every bite of chili? You want a lot of stuff.
Yes.
A good soup, lots of stuff. I don't like a creamy, consistent soup. Give me a soup with stuff in it.
Yep.
I show up to soup. I don't get out of bed for soup without stuff. It's all about the stuff. And you want a big spoon because you want to get a little bit of this stuff and a little bit of that stuff.
Yep.
Some foods you eat with a spoon, no stuff. Ice cream. Get your stuff out of my ice cream. I want a smooth.
Not a Ben and Jerry's guy.
Yep.
No.
Hmm. No, I'm with you. I generally prefer a smoother.
I want a smooth. Creamy mouthfeel with my ice cream. I want a small spoon, no stuff in the ice cream. let's see, like a fudge or like a Nutella or a honey or something like that. Like a shame thing that you would eat late at night. I don't know if you guys are yeah. familiar with this.
Oh, absolutely. Shame ice cream eater, sure.
Yeah. You know, late night, you get your little like jar of honey and you just go to town with it. Yeah. No, you don't want any stuff in there. Small spoon.
Now, and when we're talking small, we're talking like the tiny little sample spoons that you'd get from...
Look, I'm pointing
okay,
right here.
Okay, I gotcha. Okay, yeah. So it's basically like a quarter teaspoon.
The thing is, I genuinely believe they're both valid, much as like if you're drinking wine or any liquor, what glass you put it in affects the experience.
I think that's a good comparison. I would also, I have to say, creamy mouthfeel is going to have to be the title of this episode.
Yeah, I'm with you there. So I was going to re-spin this whole silverware thing, try and bring it home.
I still want, I'm going to finish the other thing. Okay. Everyone, you have to send Max an example of your favorite fork.
Yes.
You have to mail it in.
You know what?
Max, go out right now, go to, go register yourfavoritefork.com.
I think I'm going to do this. All right. By the time you're listening to this, I'll have this website together. Please go to yourfavoritefork.com and upload a picture of your favorite fork.
Make it .biz. Yourfavoritefork.biz, please. .com's available, but .biz got
Please
got
go to yourfavoritefork.biz. Upload a picture of your favorite fork, and I'll have a little comment section. You can tell me why it's your favorite, and we'll try and make available some of the really good entries.
I love this.
Once again, that is your favorite.
This is a highly directed Pinterest, is what this is.
We are so writing a jingle for this.
Now, Do you think I could? If I had a seed round for this, would you guys get in? I mean, this is a highly investable opportunity.
Well, you mean?
Well, how are we going to monetize this?
Your favorite fork .biz? No, it's the user acquisition.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, we'll see. If we,
Profitability, that's a speed bump.
Okay,
what you want is user growth.
Gotcha.
Collect underpants.
We just need eyeballs, and we need email addresses, and we need eyeballs.
You want that hockey stick growth?
Gotcha.
That's what the investors are there for.
Hey, okay. Everybody, we're looking for user
that's
growth.
Right. That's it. That's you get all of those usernames, favorite forked. And then you start wheeling out the secondary item.
That's I'm just saying that's what you call a pivot in the business.
Dear favorite forkers.
Yeah.
Guess what?
Take a look at this new thing we've developed.
Elon Musk has his thing all tied together. Yeah. I think we can have something similar.
It's like that's the thing is like you start with the Model S. That's the high-end Tesla.
That's, right. that's the fork.
That's our deciding what the favorite fork is. Now you pivot the family car. That's the cheerful blowjob robot.
Hey, everybody.
That's right.
I brought you your favorite fork while I'm here.
All right, give Pat a shitty challenge.
Pat needs a shitty... No, that was put a screen in your house. Do you have to turn it on
right.
Put a screen
so
in your
Pat,
house?
So, Pat, how are you going to accomplish it? What, are you going to give your kids some Minecraft or show them some sort
of,
you
know what? And here's
the... Why don't you show your kids some Adventure Time?
I tried. It freaked my older boy out. No, we watch Avatar. We've been watching Avatar.
Okay, well, then you know what? You've already accomplished what I was going to assign you. I was going to say I will recommend three different shows to show to your kids... And they were all going to be Avatar the Last Airbender, so we're covered.
and that is actually breaking a bit of a rule that I set up. We try to keep the physical violence in the media away from the young kids because they're little monkeys. And it's interesting because, you know, my older boy is super gentle, and my younger one, who's been watching Avatar with us this time through, it's like he's like got a stick and he's like, I'm Bender. This is my Bender stick. And he's like, and we're like, don't hit, don't hit, don't hit. But yeah, we do have screens in the house.
Okay, then show your kids the Godfather trilogy.
Go all the
and
way.
Get back to us next week.
I remember talking speed. To. We watched Pacific Rim. Sarah and I, when Oot was asleep, and we're watching it, and I'm like, I was entertained. I enjoyed it. And I was watching it, and I look at Sarah, I go, how long before we can show this to Oot? And we're watching it, and she goes, he can be 12, and he'll shit his pants. Yeah. And it was, you know, and I think we've probably, you know, collectively kind of loosened up, because we were kind of hardline about violence
that's,
in
Pat,
media.
That's the thing, is they have no defenses. It's like, they're from the new world, and you come in, and if they were to see a Pacific Rim, that's like a smallpox blanket,
you know,
of entertainment.
I'm sure Guillermo del Toro appreciates that metaphor. Yeah.
So, you know, here's and actually, I can speak specifically to this. We were staying at this B&B. We're in two different beds, smaller beds, and Sarah isn't going to be able to sleep well with both kids, you know, in this queen size. And so I'm transplanting Oot And I pick him up.
My favorite Pixar movie.
Yeah. Transplanting Oot. I pick him up and I carry him over to my bed, and he is absolutely loose. You know, absolutely just boneless.
He's just like Frida's cat from the Peanuts comic strip.
And just asleep. And I lay him in bed, and I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking how I sleep, how I have trouble sleeping, about how I worry about things. And honestly, our youngest sleeps much lighter. And I think as I'm carrying him, and I'm thinking, it's not just that he trusts me. He doesn't know that it's me doing this. You know, my child knows that he is safe.
Mm.
My eldest knows that he is safe. He is not in danger. And I think a big piece of this is he does not know how dangerous the world is, or how even dangerous the world could be, whether in a real or a fictional way. And as I picked him up and I transplanted and I tried to situate him on the bed, and he's just absolutely zonked. And I think I felt such a pride in my parenting, knowing that it's like, because like if you try to move me, like something touches me and I'm asleep, I hit Sarah once. Like she came up, she gave me a kiss, and her hair fell on my face. And as I was asleep, I thought that something, like it was a squid, because there was wetness on my face and there was hair all over.
Old ones.
And I went to like brush whatever it was, and I kind of like hit her face.
Oh.
And so she looked at me, and I'm like, I'm so sorry. I thought that there was a squid on my face.
I'm sorry. I thought you were a squid.
Yeah, but see, Pat, let me just use myself as an example. When I was Oot's age, when I was six, I couldn't sleep at night because I was scared that the aliens from Independence Day were going to come and attack my house. And look at me now. I can't decide what fork to buy.
So I'm super happy, you know, or the fact he got freaked out watching an episode of My Little Pony.
Ooh.
Came downstairs in tears. And I was happy. I was happy that he still has like emotional limits to be troubled by, you know, where, you know, and there will be time for Minecraft, you know, and yeah. I will honestly, I like, there's some shows that I super want to watch with him, but you know, it's like for me to bring him into those would just be, you know, it would be busting this flavor.
Yeah. He needs the sorbet to cleanse the palate you can throw him into the stew.
Have you thought about what that glide path might be? What's sort of the first two steps?
Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers is your glide path, and I'm dead honest serious about that. As a matter of fact, that you should show your children, you know, every episode of Mr. Rogers.
They have no context to know how out of date it is. It's the perfect crime.
You know, if I could, we tried to buy Sesame Street, but episodes of Sesame Street don't exist, you know, because... Right.
What about the Thomas the Tank Engine with George Carlin as the conductor, the good ones?
Yeah, not the Ringo ones.
Oh, I don't. I mean, he was like super geeked about Thomas back in the day. Right now, we're doing My Little Ponies.
That's a bit. Now talk about he's going to grow up and that's.
Yep, he's going to.
Might as well get him into the Juggalo videos now.
You know, he's watching My Little Pony, and he said to me the other day, he goes, you know, there actually are some boys in that. And I'm like, oh, he noticed.
Yeah.
He noticed now, as opposed to all these other shows where it's, you know, and also violence usually fails in My Little Pony.
Yeah.
You see, I'd love to watch Powerpuff Girls, but it's like, it's not good for him.
Yeah, violent-based.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you know, I watched, you know, occasionally, like, any of the Miyazaki, the one I'd love to watch is Princess Mononoke, but it's like too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much. We were watching Book of Life, which was this great, great thing. And he, like, some of it was scary or whatever, but we got to the point where he was singing to the bull, you know, in hell,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the dead bulls congeal into the big bull, Voltron. And he's singing this song, you know, like, to effectively apologize to all these bulls that his family has killed over the years. And he starts to cry. Oot starts to cry, and he's like, and it, graphically, it was kind of, it was this huge scene. It was climactic. And he goes, and so we pause it and we're like, what's the matter? And he says, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But what it was is that this was an amazingly intense emotional scene.
Yeah.
And he was actually having an emotional response that kind of rose up in him. And I'm glad that he has that sensitivity in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry that like Sarah can enjoy foods that I can't because like I have been rough on my palate. And I think I'm raising my boy that he might be able to have more sensitive social interactions.
You're raising a yogurt boy.
Well,
yogurt boy.
All right, we gotta call it here so you guys don't miss your SpongeBob.
Yeah.
Paul and Storm, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks
Where can
us.
People find your excellent, very funny, and very good music?
You can find us at paulandstorm.com, on Twitter at Paul and Storm. We're on Instagram at Paul and Storm, but we never use it.
You can, our big project is, as mentioned, I believe, Joko Cruz, jokocruz.com. And that's really the biggest stuff. Oh, and you can, it'll be a while, but you'll hear some of our funny product on the Mystery Science Theater 3000 reboot.
Yeah, we're staff writers on the Mystery Science Theater reboot, so that's a ridiculous amount of fun and a genuine, honest-to-God dream job.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. We're good.
Yeah. Thanks.
That was a funny one.
That was fun.
That was fun.
Yogurt boy.
Yogurt boy.
Raising a yogurt boy.